Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. School teachers matter. We know that. And many of them get into the field with the highest ideals and passion. So why then do so many end up quitting? What's going wrong in our classrooms that is driving teachers out of the profession at the rate of up to 50% who leave within the first 5 years of the job? We want good teachers, but why can't we keep them? Those who are quitting cite the mandated testing and not getting any respect. The joy of teaching, it's getting lost and not being found. This hour, On Point, teachers on why they leave. We're going to be talking with three teachers who will discuss with us why they quit. Joining me first in the studio is Susie Slider. She taught in public and private schools in Massachusetts for the last three decades and in a Cambridge public school as a kindergarten teacher for the last 15 years. She left public school teaching last year, and she now teaches in a private early education program in Medford, Massachusetts. Susie Slider, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here, John.
Also from Lafayette, Louisiana, is Andrea Thibodeau. She taught 5th and 7th grade science, language arts, social studies in Louisiana's Lafayette Parish Public Schools for 20 years. She retired last January in her mid-40s, so we are calling that early retirement. That's long before she meant to be leaving teaching. Welcome, Andrea, to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And finally from San Francisco is Amanda Machado. She graduated from Brown University in 2010. She signed up for Teach for America. She was assigned a charter school in the Bay Area where she did teach ninth grade English from 2010 to 2012. She is now a contributing writer at The Atlantic. You can actually link to her December article for the magazine, very much on topic, Why Teachers of Color Quit. Welcome, Amanda Machado.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have all three of you here. And I want to start with the beginnings of your careers and just ask you, starting with you, Susie Slider, did you have the passion? Did you start this career with a passion and a love for teaching?
Oh, absolutely. I knew I wanted to go into teaching from when I was quite young. Definitely in my college years, I was preparing for that and working toward that. And there was nothing that I was more attracted to than being a classroom teacher with young children.
What was the attraction?
I always loved young children, loved the play and joyfulness that I was engaged in when I was with them. And I guess I just felt like that was my calling. I'm a passionate educator. I love learning. I love being with children and in that energy of creative exploration.
Okay. And Amanda Machado, same question to you. When you started out, and for you it was fewer years ago than for our other two guests, but when you started out back in 2010 and those years leading up to your graduation from Brown University, what made you want to be a teacher?
Yeah, I think for me it was a lot of my own background. I come from a middle-class family. My parents are immigrants from Mexico and Ecuador. And I think just growing up, I was seeing a lot of the inequities in education myself, and I really was passionate about trying to solve those through being a teacher in the classroom. So I was very attracted to Teach for America and the profession of teaching, just for mostly that social justice aspect of solving these inequalities and making sure everyone has access to a good education.
So you had a little bit of a change the world fire in you as well.
I think so, yes.
All right. And Andrea Thibodeau in Lafayette, Louisiana, you taught 5th and 7th grade science. You went on for 20 years, and as we said earlier, you stopped teaching in your mid-40s much earlier than you planned to get out of teaching. So in the context of this program, we're talking about people who, even after 20 or 15 to 20 years, if you've left before you were going to, we consider that quitting. We consider that bailing out for some reason. So where did you start out in terms of your attitude towards teaching? Why did you want to get into it?
Again, for me, my dad was a teacher, and so I saw his passion for teaching, and I went into it teaching the lower grades. My dad taught high school, so I ended up with a degree in 1st through 8th grade, thinking that I wanted to teach the smaller children, but ended up teaching the middle school children, and I loved middle school. They're different, definitely, but but I ended up having a passion for teaching those kids, and I just was surrounded by such great teachers and administrators at the time that that it caused me to have a greater passion for my job. You know, I enjoyed doing my job.
So it's fair to say that you, too, were on fire about this field.
Definitely, definitely.
All right. So all three of you, the fire's gone out, and we want to figure out why. And let's start with you, Susie Slider. Again, to remind people, you taught in private and public schools in Massachusetts, but you've left public school teaching behind. That's really what we're talking about here. Why did the fire go out for you?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I identify as a public school teacher. I believe in public school and quality public school. And so it was very exciting for me to work my way into a public school setting.
You felt like you'd made it.
I felt like I'd made it. I'd found the school that I loved. It was actually a social justice school as well. Our theme, overarching theme within the school was social justice. It was named after Martin Luther King.
Who were the kids?
The kids were from the city of Cambridge, and which is a diverse city. There were kids of all different socioeconomic backgrounds, kids from all over the world. So in any given classroom of mine, I had many children from different countries speaking different languages. One year I had 14 different languages in my classroom. Mm. And there was the diversity was wonderful to teach within because I could do so much with that diversity and helping children to learn about the world.
So what went wrong?
Oh, I feel that it started for me a number of years ago. I connected to No Child Left Behind and all of the focus that we have been distracted with around data collection and assessment testing that has taken the focus away from the child and child-centered teaching and brought us to look at children in terms of scores, test scores, and what they don't know, sort of a deficit model, rather than being able to look at them, get to know them, and see them for their strengths.
So where did that put you as a teacher?
I feel like it has taken me, sort of pulled me away from what I love doing most, which is being a creative facilitator of learning within a classroom, scaffolding exciting learning for children, and really brought me into a focus on scores and assessments.
So this just became something you actually didn't want to do.
I'm not – yeah, I don't want to do that. That's a totally different job than what I used to do, really.
Okay, let me go to Amanda Machado in San Francisco. Where did it go wrong for you?
Yeah, well, I think there were multiple reasons. I don't think for me it was one specific thing. I think I struggle with the same things many teachers struggle with, being exhausted, burnt out, not knowing work-life balance. You know, obviously there's problems in the classroom, problems with administration. But for the piece that I wrote, I think the two things that I focused on that weren't being talked about that seemed to specifically be challenges for teachers of color was the issue of diversity first, which I think what that means is it's really hard to teach students who share your same racial identity. There's an emotional side to that that is very different, and it's much harder when you don't know other teachers that also share that same racial identity as our students, or might not understand it. 40% of public school students now are Black or Latino, but only 13% of teachers are. So I think there's a loneliness to that, to being a teacher of color and sharing the same background as your kids. The majority of my students were Black or Latino, but not knowing who to talk to about that or how whether other teachers understand it.
So you felt a little bit of collegial isolation then, as well as problems with the system overall.
Yeah, and then I think it also can relate to what Susie was saying, that it also affects how you teach. You know, I think I wanted to look at the cultural backgrounds of our students whenever we were making decisions, and when I was making decisions about how to teach them, I'm not just thinking about test results or college results even. I'm kind of thinking about how are we preparing these students for all the inequalities they're going to face outside the classroom or the life they live outside the classroom, which is very different than what I think most most teachers are thinking about.
And Andrea Thibodeau, you're last up in this list of what went wrong. So maybe you echo a little bit of what you've heard already.
Definitely. When Susie was speaking, I felt like that was my story. I felt very much the same way. When I first started teaching, I felt like we focused on relationship with children. You know, we really paid attention to mentoring kids and not only teaching them the subject areas, but teaching them socially. We had more time for that. I mean, we're always limited in time, but back then I felt like we had more time for that. Now I feel that we're so busy testing kids that all we have time for is the paperwork that's mandated.
Does it feel like you're not able to do what you trained to do and that the job changed on you?
Definitely changed on us. I feel like we're just paper pushers now, constantly handing out papers, constantly grading papers, and not focusing on the children anymore. You know, I felt like in the past when I first started teaching, I really focused on my students. I focused on, you know, I taught a high poverty level group of kids when I first started teaching. But back then, I was more creative. I was able to use my creativity to work with those kids. And I can't do that anymore
because
so busy testing.
I want to ask you to hold while we take a little bit of a break, but I want to then come back and find out why was there not an option to fight within the system? And folks, you can join our conversation. Has our focus on testing gone too far, as we're just hearing, taking away from kids' experience in the classroom? I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking with three teachers about how the profession is changing and why those changes led them to quit the profession. When I say quit the profession, by the way, I mean left the world of public school teaching, because some of them have found jobs in teaching elsewhere. So we are talking with Susie Slider, who taught for 3 decades in Massachusetts and for the last 15 years as a kindergarten teacher in Cambridge. She left her school last June for a private early education program in Medford, Massachusetts. And with Andrea Thibodeau, who taught 5th and 7th grade science, language arts, and social studies in Louisiana's Lafayette Parish Public Schools for 20 years. She retired last January, but she's in her mid-40s, so let's call that early. That was long before she meant to leave teaching. And also with Amanda Machado, who signed up for Teach for America and was assigned a charter school in the Bay Area. And she left right after her 2-year commitment to that ended. And Andrea Thibodeau, you all three of you have some overlap in your reasons for leaving. What it sounds in all cases, some of it had to do with testing. With Amanda Machado, it had to do with the sense that as a person of color, that she was a little bit left on her own in trying to figure out a way to talk to and work with her students, but also with her colleagues. But in all cases, what I hear from all of you is a sense of powerlessness, helplessness, which makes me want to sort of tease out more this question of why didn't you stick it out and try to change from within? And let's start with you, Andrea Thibodeau, in Lafayette Parish. Why give up instead of fight on?
Well, for me, we have a lot of issues in our own school board here, in our Lafayette Parish school board. I find that teachers don't band together because they're fearful, you know.
Afraid of what?
I think just fearful to lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. Even this past year when I left, we had a few teachers speaking out about what was going on in the classrooms. And a couple of them were sort of ousted, you know. And one of them in particular was, and I don't know what his situation was, but I know teachers fear that. You know, they're fearful that if they speak up, that something's going to happen to their job. They need their jobs. You know, a lot of these teachers, this is their livelihood. And they love the teaching profession. They really do. But they are frustrated and they feel unsupported, very unsupported. I'm not sure how teachers can band together and change this. You know, it's going to take an effort by all teachers to come together.
Susie Slider, that phrase unsupported, what does it mean to be unsupported and what is support?
That's a great question. I feel I totally agree with Andrea that there has been lack of support. And I think for me it felt that my voice as an educator, an experienced educator, was not heard.
And it used to be?
Oh, yes, it used to be. I used to feel like I could speak with the administrator that I worked under, and there was an understanding, there was a definite respect. And what changed in my school is we had a new principal come in, and there was a new higher administration that I felt was putting more pressure on principals to do certain things, such as implement assessments and sort of the data collection environment. And so I didn't feel there was room for my voice anymore, even though I would use my voice. The administrator I worked under, the principal I worked under, respected me in that he would talk with me and listen, but it didn't have any effect. Mm-hmm. So in terms of being able to affect change in a positive way, I felt powerless.
And Amanda Machado, you did 2 years of Teach for America, and you're not talking about, as your two colleagues here, you're not talking about the better days the way that it used to be. You got into a system where from day one you felt challenged. And I'm wondering also about the question of whether you felt you had power, that you could speak up.
Yeah, well, I think that becomes very complicated. My administration in a lot of ways was very supportive. So I don't think it's easy to just blame on one certain thing, at least for me. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's just the environment that's kind of everywhere, and I think that was what made me feel jaded. That I didn't think there was just one simple solution or thing that could change that would make me feel better. I think it was just a general environment that we had created that wasn't acknowledging certain things about students and about where they come from and looking at a child holistically. And I think that's what I struggled with. I didn't know how to solve that, and I didn't want to keep teaching if I was going to be a teacher who was doubting whether I should stay in the profession. I knew I had to stay in it if I was passionate, and if I wasn't anymore, the kids deserved a teacher that was.
Let's bring in some of you listeners who I think are actually lining up to become part of this conversation. Let's bring Lisa from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Hi, thank you.
Sure. What are you thinking?
Well, I teach at Lesley University, where we've got a bunch of students training to be teachers with the passion and the fire in their bellies, and it's very sad to me to learn about the number of teachers who do feel that this climate is squashing the creativity and that it is fueled with this competitive edge. And in fact, I echo Susie's comments about the administrators feeling the crunch as well. So I guess really I feel there's a need for a coming together, as was already mentioned, but really hoping to garner support so that it's not viewed as teachers quitting and giving up, but really making a conscious choice that there are other ways to reach young children and families. It's just a shame that the public education system isn't there in the same ways to support these children and families.
But if you're at an institution which is training teachers, what are you telling them about the world that they're getting into? Are you preparing them for the realities that we're hearing about on the program?
We are preparing them for the realities, and they notice this by the number of increased assessments that they're required to look at, and we try to be very truthful about the climate that they're going to be entering, but we do focus a lot on what we consider to be the fundamental values like relationships and creative approaches to curriculum in spite of increasing mandates. So we try to keep a balance but mm-hmm. keep the reality for them so that they recognize that they will have to make some choices. And as they do enter public education or independent schools, you know, over time they do develop the networks and the contacts so that they do feel a stronger sense of support.
All right, Lisa, thanks very much for your point. Andrew Thibodeau in Lafayette Parish, Louisiana, if you had the power that you say you don't have, what would be happening in your classroom right now, today? Let's pick one of your classrooms. You taught social studies. What would be happening today that is not happening because you didn't have the power?
I think for me, it would be to be able to use creativity again, to be able to step away from the curriculum that they force us to teach, and to be more creative, to be able to use my ideas in the classroom, and to actually look at the students, that group of students that I teach that particular year, and see what is it that I need for them.
Can you be more specific than be creative? I mean, can you picture a day, a class, a sentence, something that you would say or do or study that you couldn't because of the standardization?
You know, I really, what I'll do is compare for you.
Okay.
I can remember a time where we didn't have a specific curriculum that we had to follow. And we used a particular program called Alabama Integrated Science. And this was in a high poverty school. And we did experiments almost daily in the science program. And these kids learned. We were able to use these experiments to reach kids back then.
You mean laboratory? You don't mean educational experiments. You mean the kids were doing science experiments
right,
in science class.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Science experiments, lab experiments. And it was great. And the kids remember that. I mean, I still have
and
students
come back
today.
And they can't do that now?
We don't have the time for it. With the curriculum that we have now, we're supposed to teach everything by a certain date so these kids can be tested on it. And so we're busy shoving it down their throats, basically. Unfortunately, that's what it's come to be.
Susie Slider, let me take the question to Susie Slider. What would you be doing in a classroom today if you had the power?
Oh, it's remarkable how similar Andrea and I are. I feel at the same level. I mean, at kindergarten, it looks like, in a similar way, engaging hands-on and helping kids to learn creatively. So that at a kindergarten level is through play and through investigations. So, for example, this year I'm teaching with some student teachers a whole unit that's extended over the course of the year on sand and water. And it was just an exploration. We set out because kids were playing with sand and water in a really fascinating way, and they were really into it. So we took that energy, that creative energy, and engagement, and we went with it. And they've with their questioning, brought us through a whole exploration.
And what has happened to the sand and water part of school?
In most kindergarten classrooms, there's no time for that kind of exploration. It takes,
and not because anybody thinks that was a bad lesson.
I don't know that it's about people making decisions about what's a good lesson or a bad lesson. There's just no room for it anymore because of the way that teachers' days are so fragmented with skills-based testing or skills-based teaching, uh-huh. and then all of the assessments and ways teachers are brought out of the classroom to get trainings. It's so fragmented now. It takes a huge amount of focus on a teacher's part to teach in that way.
And Amanda Machado, if you had the power, what would have happened in your classroom that you could do?
I think I would have tried to find ways to make lessons more relevant to their cultural and racial backgrounds and mm-hmm. the realities of their situation outside of home. I think a lot of the material I taught often went over their heads because they had, frankly, much more pressing issues going on in their communities and at home than the things I was teaching. So there was an
irrelevance to the course material that was imposed upon you to teach to the kids. Is that what you're saying? An irrelevance
it
in their lives?
It wasn't necessarily even imposed on me. I think you just look at standards. I mean, I was a first-year teacher. I didn't have very much experience. So I looked at standards and what students needed to learn by the end of the year and tried to do my best. I think ultimately what I learned at the end was that I needed to be focusing, and all teachers should be focusing a lot more on the question of how are we going to allow our students to advocate for themselves, mm-hmm. To be better citizens in society. And those are the big picture questions that I don't think are often asked anymore because we're too focused on the smaller things, which are just typical standards.
Let me bring into the conversation now a new voice. This is Madeline Isaacson, and she is in Tacoma, Washington, and she just now received her master's from the School of Education at the University of Puget Sound. And she will be starting her career as a teacher, first grade at a public elementary school outside of Tacoma. Congratulations, Madeline, and welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, and I assume you've been listening to these unhappy stories.
Yes, I have.
Do they give you pause?
They make me a little bit nervous, but it's nothing that I wasn't aware of already going into the profession.
And so is the education that you're getting to be a teacher dealing with these kinds of issues and talking about these problems and training you for them and training you in a way differently from the way that these women were taught, do you think?
Yeah, I think like the caller was talking about previously in the education program that she works in, University of Puget Sound really helped through my student teaching for me to see the reality of teaching, working with my mentor teacher and seeing the time that she was putting in to all these assessments and to the grading that she was doing and the realities of working in the classroom that I did that has a high poverty rate and very diverse students, I think helped to prepare me as much as it could for the reality. My program really tried to focus on looking at big enduring understandings that we could teach. And while we are given this curriculum and while we have to have some fidelity to the curriculum, ways that we could alter it to look for bigger questions and bigger enduring understandings that really would stick with our kids for years to come.
So you're pretty optimistic.
I am.
And in the term I was using earlier in the broadcast, you are on fire about teaching.
Absolutely.
So Susie Slider, it sounds like you 20, 30 years ago. What do you hear in Madeline's voice?
Oh, I love it. I love hearing your voice, Madeline, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm excited for you. I'm sad that you're entering education in a time that's so trying, but I feel like I put a tremendous amount of my hope in the newer teachers coming in because the tide will turn. It will. It always does. And you'll be there and I'm sure it sounds like you have a very solid passion in education and you will rise to the occasion.
And Amanda Machado, would you give any advice to Madeline as she launches on this? You were there only 3 years ago, brand new at this.
Yeah, well, congratulations again. I would say just to celebrate the small victories, particularly in your first year. Forgive yourself for the mistakes you'll make and reevaluate as much as you can and reassess and learn from your mistakes and make changes. But celebrate the small victories and focus on the locus of control, on your classroom, on the things that you can change, because there will be a lot of things that you can't. And it's not beneficial to focus on that. It's much more beneficial to focus on your students and what you can change immediately.
And what would you say, Andrea Thibodeau?
Oh, I totally agree with both Amanda and with Susie. Definitely don't focus. I mean, focus on the little victories. That's a beautiful way to. That's a beautiful piece of advice to give to a new teacher. I would say find a great teacher in the school you're in, one that you look up to, one that you think is the epitome of an excellent teacher. Have her as your mentor, him as your mentor, because I think that's another thing that we're lacking in the school systems today, that we're spending so much time on testing and on paperwork that administrators aren't finding great mentors for new teachers coming in. So find a mentor, when that first year teaching.
Madeline, did anybody in your life, your family, friends, advise you against going into teaching given the climate?
Not given the climate. I mean, I was told when I was younger, I've always wanted to be a teacher. Since I was like a little girl, I really felt called. And I've been told before, oh, Madeline, you're so smart. Don't you want to do something else with your life? To which I say, why wouldn't we want intelligent educators? But my family has been incredibly supportive of me chasing my dream and seeing how much passion I have for education.
Well, we want to have you back on in 10 years and find out that it's all been a success story. So, Madeline Isaacson, thanks very much for joining us from Tacoma, Washington.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to talk a little bit about what Madeline just said, Susie Slider, her friend saying, oh, well, you're so smart. Why don't you go do something else with your life? And that comes to a very sensitive issue of respect or lack of respect for teachers. Is this something that you've struggled with and heard throughout your career?
I guess I've heard it definitely throughout my career and much more so in recent years. There seems to be a lot of blaming that continually goes on these days of teachers. And there's a lot of there's a turn away from collaboration with teachers. And teachers' voices are so important. And so these are the people who have, dedicated their lives to learning how to work with children and should be an integral part of developing assessments and thinking about curriculum, and we're not. And so I feel like that statement holds so much in it that is sad for me. Of course, this is one of the most important jobs people can do, and we need our most intelligent, most skilled teacher people to go into teaching.
Well, let's talk a little bit when we come back and hear from some listeners about whether teachers are being welcomed into the career and respected. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking with three public school teachers on why they left teaching. We are talking with Susie Slider, who taught for three decades, the last 15 years as a kindergarten teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She left last June to work in private early education in Medford, Massachusetts. Also with Andrea Thibodeau, who taught 5th and 7th grade science, language arts, and social studies in Louisiana's Lafayette Parish Public Schools for 20 years. She retired last January in her mid-40s, long before she intended to leave teaching. And with Amanda Machado, who signed up for Teach for America and was assigned a charter school in the Bay Area. She left after her two-year commitment ended. And Amanda Machado, you only really signed up. Teach for America is normally a two-year commitment. And lots of people come into the program to sort of test out teaching and then move on. So it's not that unusual for people to not make a career of it after Teach for America. But I'm wondering, I just want to clarify whether that was the case for you, because people switch careers all the time. Is it different in your case with leaving teaching? Had you seen the possibility of making a long-term career of it?
I did. My internships in college were all with education nonprofits or with teaching type internships. So it was definitely something I was really interested in. The college I had, I chose not to ultimately major in education, so I thought Teach for America would be a good way of becoming a teacher without having to go through the traditional certification process. It is true, though, that there are many people who do Teach for America with the intention of later going to law school or med school or pursuing other things. But that was not my case at first. I really did want to try it out and see if I loved it and could stick with it.
Do you agree with a little bit of what was hinted at earlier, that teaching has lost its prestige? And you know, especially you're talking about the kinds of careers that other people in Teach of America seem to be going into, which I think on the prestige scale probably have a higher score. Medicine and law, however you might feel about doctors or lawyers. I think we can agree that teachers doesn't have that prestige, and maybe that it once did. Did you sense that when you went into the field?
Absolutely. And I agree with what others were saying about students sensing it as well. I definitely had same comments of, oh, but, you know, you went to Brown. Why are you a teacher? And my kids could even tell. They would tell me, you know, after all you've worked hard for, why are you here teaching us?
Really? They sniffed out that you were in a low prestige?
Yeah, they could tell. Oh. I mean, it's that ingrained, I think, in our society that even kids can tell that it's not a prestigious thing to do. It's not something that if you've worked very hard, that it's a career that you'd want to pursue. And I think especially what I mentioned in my article was that for teachers of color, I think there's even more pressure to kind of prove to others that you've made it. Mm-hmm. Often we're the first people to graduate from college or from an elite college. So with that comes this pressure, I think, that we put on ourselves to find a career that gives us prestige or is financially rewarding or makes us feel like all of our hard work was worth it. And sadly, I think teaching doesn't necessarily provide that, at least the way our society has perceived it.
Susie Slider, I saw you nodding when Amanda was talking about the kids being able to sniff out the lack of prestige of the people at the head of the class standing in front of them. You had kindergarten kids. They couldn't have figured that out.
No. I guess I was nodding because I'm not surprised. Right. I feel like I agree with Amanda that it's just so ingrained in our society.
And Andrew Thibodeau, what about you on this question of the prestige and respect that comes to the profession?
I haven't experienced what she's saying. I've met a lot of people who feel for teachers right now, but I do understand. You know, I've heard of that same lack of respect toward other teachers. The only disrespect I see is from students as a whole. That's changed a lot.
Is that a discipline question, or is that a social respect question, or are they the same thing?
I think it's the same thing. I think it's the same thing. Yes, I think both socially they have a lack of respect for teachers, because I find that, you know, a while back Amanda had mentioned that there's not one particular place to blame, and I agree with her. But what one of the things that I'm seeing in the classroom is that because there's so much pressure on administrators for less write-ups, less suspensions, less expulsions, that they don't handle the discipline the same way that they used to. You know, at one point, disrespect was not allowed in the classroom or in schools, but there's so much more allowed now. And the kids see that, you know, the kids see that.
Let's bring in Krista from Berkshire, Vermont. Hi, Krista, what do you have to say?
Well, I've been I'm not a teacher, but it's very interesting, the conversations I'm listening to. I am a volunteer, have been for 28 years at the Berkshire School. I have five classes, and I teach them writing, reading, especially reading, and the discussion of what we read, and we read adult books.
Mm-hmm. So, but how do you feel that focuses on the experience of these that these teachers are having?
It's that the things are not as clear anymore, the teaching, as they used to be, because of the like the teacher said, they have too many obligations. Mm-hmm. And the children don't really fall into the equation anymore.
Yeah. Well, we've been hearing that quite a bit from the three teachers here, and in terms also of this matter of support that teachers are given. I keep hearing and researching for this program stories of teachers actually reaching into their own pockets to pay for the materials in the classroom. I've heard chuckles and nodding. See nodding. Who's chuckling out there? Is that?
Andrea Thibodeau.
Yeah, Andrea Thibodeau, because I can't see you, but I heard you. Have you actually spent your own money on supplies for your classroom?
Definitely. Hundreds of dollars.
Hundreds
every
of dollars?
Year. Oh, easily, yes.
But where is the process incentive? Where you go to the principal's office and say, I need money for supplies?
We do that, and we're given a limited amount of money every year in our classrooms. And sometimes we don't want to go through all the hassle of that. Sometimes it just takes too much effort to go through that, and we get what we need, when we're shopping. I know in science, when I taught science, because we had so many activities, we ended up spending lots of money out of our own pocket to do activities and experiments with the students, you know, and especially incentives. I know we do pizza parties for our kids, and that comes out of my own pocket when I do pizza parties for the kids.
Do you think people know this?
Probably not. Our parents, I believe, know. You know, some of the parents who's the kids that we teach, but probably not. I don't think the vast majority of people really understand how much money teachers put into their classrooms.
Let's bring in Dawn from Lexington, Kentucky. Dawn, hi. Welcome to On Point.
You. Are you there?
Dawn, hi.
Oh, sorry. Hi, how are you?
Good. I think that was more my mistake than yours, but welcome to the program. What are you thinking?
Well, I just wanted to add, you know, I taught public school for 1 year, 20 years ago. It was my first job out of college, 26-ish, you know, around there. And I had a principal who made me change grades. I taught primarily seniors in high school, mm-hmm. and he had me change, go back in the programs and change grades.
Why? Why?
Well, so they would pass and be graduated and out of the school. And to this day, that particular county still has, like, it's maybe in the top 10 in the nation of graduating seniors.
And so how did that experience make you feel as a teacher, as the person who's supposed to be deciding the grades?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I felt, I just resonate with what they're saying. I mean, talk about lack of support. You know, I mean, as a first year teacher, I'm just trying to follow the rules and do what I'm told, and you know, there's no commitment for the next year for a job. And so I just was very flustered. To this day, it still bothers me. I actually, when I had my own children, I've never taught again, and I homeschool my children. So I just don't participate. It definitely just sort of pulled the rug out from under me and just really gave me a sour taste for public schools. Although I have great friends who are teachers and even principals at this point, but it definitely changed the trajectory of my life, really, what I had planned to do. I do enjoy teaching my children at home, but just kind of not what I planned when I started out with a degree in.
Sounding very familiar to our guests, I think. Let's bring in Clint from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Clint. You're on Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I've been a teacher. I finished my first year of teaching music in a urban public school district, and I also have been substitute teaching for about 6 years, both in a suburban school district and a private school. And the main thing that I see is, kind of like your panelists were saying, we move from learning, being in education. I got my master's degree, and I moved from, you know, having an environment where I've got lots of mentors and I'm learning the craft of teaching to an environment where you're basically navigating through a bureaucracy and you have no mentors and no people feeding you encouragement and inspiration as in the classroom environment that you just came out of. And the other thing is that these tests and the assessments are not doing what they were designed to do, and they're really only benefiting the testing companies that are making tons and tons of money off of materials, you know, prep materials, and then teachers are having to take praxis tests again and again, sometimes two or three times. And
all right, Clint, thanks for those thoughts. I want to get in one more call from Jan, calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jan.
I came out of education from Albion College in 1990. I took a teaching job at John Muir Middle School in Vermont, on Vermont, South Central LA. The contract was $32,000 in the year 99-2000. My question that's not addressed is, we all agree teachers should be paid more, but we don't do anything to attract talent by truly paying teachers more.
It's a good point, Jen. Jen, we haven't actually talked about the salary issue, and let me ask Susie Slider about that. I mean, I feel like it's such a huge softball to say to you, our teachers underpaid, but let's put it in terms of the amount of education that you have to put into it and equity with other professions. What about the issue of teacher pay?
I think it's a real issue. I think it's important that teachers are paid enough to live on and not to have to supplement it with other incomes, which a lot of teachers need to do, particularly when they're starting out. So teacher salaries are really important to raise so that you're also attracting people who to the profession. I feel that another thing is to look to have it be a more difficult profession to enter into, so that you're getting much more high qualified teachers who are going to really make a commitment to that full learning process that goes on for years with professional development, and then providing that support through mentors and professional development once they're there.
This whole issue of the pay issue, the lack of support, makes me wonder whether those who stay are the super teachers or whether those who stay are teachers who are people who are willing to put up with all the difficulty just because they need the paycheck. And that raises in my mind the question of are there great teachers who are out there who are hanging on and fighting the system? And let me put that to you, Amanda Machado. You were the newest into the system and probably the most in need of a mentor. Did you find great teachers where you were working?
Oh, definitely. They're definitely out there, for sure. But I think what you said kind of encapsulates it perfectly. I think you have to be a super teacher to kind of deal with a lot of these problems that are happening in the classroom or outside of it, in a way that teaching becomes this full lifetime commitment. It can't just be a job that you do 9 to 5 and pursue, you know, other interests or hobbies on the side. It becomes your life. And I think the unfortunate part is that a lot of people are very passionate about education, passionate about teaching, but don't think they can make that full lifetime commitment, and that's why they end up leaving. And I think that's where we miss out on a lot of people that would be great teachers but can't bring themselves to make that much of a sacrifice that's required.
Andrew Thibodeau, in Lafayette Parish Public Schools, did you encounter great teachers, and are the great ones staying or are the great ones bailing?
I encountered many great teachers, and there are lots of great teachers still out there. Yes, I definitely think there's lots of teachers that are sticking it out. There's many of them. Many of them are right in the middle, you know, 10 years into this. And it is a struggle to make a decision as to whether to stay in the system or not, just because of the lack of respect that's there for them. But there are many staying and sticking it out. I see in the last school that I was in and in the former school that I taught, the first school, both.
But does this mean then, Susie Slider, that you can actually still be a great teacher?
Oh, I agree with both Amanda and Andrea about how many wonderful teachers are there. And I think part of what I'm seeing in my colleagues who are staying because they need to stay or that they want to stay and stick it out is that they are feeling somewhat deadened also. And they're trying to hold on to the things, the parts that are allow them to feel alive and creative and passionate. And it's becoming more and more difficult. They struggle, and yet they're there because they love the children and they are passionate about the profession.
Well, we heard that in the voice of Madeline Isaacson before, that she really believes in it. And potentially, you know, who knows, she may turn out to be a great teacher. But do you think in the longer run, if things don't change, that the quality of teachers is going to decline because of this, Susie?
I absolutely do. And the quality of the education that we're providing our children. I think that's already happened.
Andrew Thibodeau, do you agree with that? That's pretty bleak assessment.
Definitely. I agree that it's changing now. You know, I can see it. I can see it happening now, unfortunately. But, the number of teachers, I'm sure the number is declining, people going into the education and the quality, because they don't have the mentors to teach them how to be great teachers.
And we have time for one last question to Amanda Machado, and it's this. Amanda, you went in, you spent 2 years, and you left, and you're looking for other things to do in life. Do you regret the 2 years you spent teaching? And second part, do you regret the fact that you're not going to be a teacher?
No, I don't regret any of it. I think it is so valuable to understand or at least have personal experience with the public education system and know at least somewhat how it works, and to be able to form your own opinions about it based on that. I think that's completely valuable. I had a great time in a lot of ways. I loved my kids. I loved my classroom. I can't really regret that either.
I want to thank all three of you for joining us. Susie Slider, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, John.
Andrea Thibodeau, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And Amanda Machado, good luck to you at the start of your new career.
Thank you for having me as well.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, California massacre, Obama's foreign policy vision, Snowden speaks out. It will be our weekly news roundtable going behind the headlines. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.